Hey everybody, Melissa McKenzie, publisher of The American Spectator, here at the Spectacle. And you'll notice Scott McKay, my co-host, is not here because he is dealing with COVID right now and hacking up a lung over in sad Louisiana. So he will not be with us today, but I am joined by an amazing guest. Her name is Carrie Sheffield. She's written this book, Motorhome Prophecies, which I urge you to go out and buy. And it is about your trek from growing up in a cult, Carrie, all the way to where you have landed now, which we'll find out in a minute where that is. But welcome to the spectacle, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. And I'm sorry your co-host is not feeling well, but hopefully he's back and hitting the road, rubber hitting the road soon.
Well, he's responding to abusive emails. So I think he'll be okay.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we had a couple beforehand. He said, "Be nice to the guests since I'm not around to, be abused by you." I was like, "I'll do what I can." So you start off on your journey talking about your family of origin and taking it through all the way to your conversion to Christianity and starting off in a sect of Mormonism, or would you say it was mainstream Mormonism and with a flair added by your father?
Yeah, so we were always kind of teetering on the brink just growing up. And then eventually, after I was an adult, my dad was excommunicated from the Mormon Church, but that wasn't until 2013. But we were constantly in and out of sometimes going to the mainstream church and then sometimes doing our own services at home. And my dad would often say, "I believe someday I will be excommunicated." I think because he knew that what he was doing was not sanctioned by the official LDS Church. And so I'm very careful in the book to talk about that what my dad did was, I believe, a cult, but the LDS Church I do not believe is a cult. I theologically am not aligned with the LDS Church anymore. And I think they do wonderful work, humanitarian work in some areas. They have really strong family culture in some areas in terms of like community cohesion. And they're also demographically in a much better place in terms of like holding their market share in the US, whereas Protestants and Catholics are, I mean, Protestants in particular are having a nosedive. So there's a lot of cultural practices within Mormonism that I think are good. Unfortunately, my dad chose to create his own culture and is literally his own cult. And the title of the book, as you said, is Motorhome Prophecies because I have seven biological siblings and my parents. So we had 10 people for large parts of my childhood living in the motorhome together. We also sometimes we lived in houses. So I would say that we were careening sometimes between a first world existence and then a third world existence. My mother gave birth to one of my five brothers when the family didn't even have a motorhome and was living in a tent. So I have lived in tents. I have lived in sheds, like storage sheds and motorhomes. When I took my ACT exam, we were living in a shed in the Ozarks with no running water. But sometimes we had houses and sometimes we tried to be normal. I ended up going to 17 public schools and homeschool. And unfortunately, just because of all the spiritual and psychological and physical abuse at some points, not having food, and being on welfare and church welfare, in and out of stability and instability, it just was so much that two of my brothers developed schizophrenia and one of them tried to rape me. Eventually, three of my siblings attempted suicide, and I, for many years, had on and off suicidal ideation and PTSD and anxiety and depression, all while trying to build a career. And I call this book as my anti-resume. So building your resume and having a successful career, but having the shadow or anti-resume. Finally, I said, "You know what? I'm going to write the anti-resume book." So that's what this book is.
Well, it is deeply personal, and you talk about mental illness throughout both your father's with narcissistic personality disorder, and your brother's, and then you mentioned your own borderline personality disorder. And I was wondering, how much do you think, how much do you attribute your experience, the environment, to where you ended up psychologically, and how much do you attribute to genetics, considering?
Yeah, and with schizophrenia, there's no known exact cause for it, but I have, they say the my big fat Greek wedding, that I have a big fat Mormon family. And out of, at this point, hundreds of cousins and second cousins, and nobody has schizophrenia. And so to have two in one family, I think is a statistical anomaly in terms of, it usually tends to be a combination of nature and nurture. So I would say on my dad's side, we probably do have chemical imbalance tendencies toward depression and anxiety and things like that chemically. And there is scientific evidence that it can be transmitted genetically to certain tendencies. However, and there's even a tendency I talk about in the book of it's an and I know the word neurodivergence thrown around a lot, but it's called a highly sensitive person in HSP, but it is shown chemically in your brain in terms of how your amygdala and your insula, certain regions of your brain are activated in a higher level than non-HSP people. And according to the rubrics for this, I and my dad are like, and I would say all my siblings are off the charts HSP, which is, it can be a superpower, but also can drag you down. It basically gives you super empathy. You have high levels of empathy and understanding. I think a lot of journalists are HSP. A lot of people who go into clergy who have a deep respect and compassion for suffering and humanity. But the downside is if you, and so you absorb, you basically absorb your environment and emotional, you have, your brain's able to process things more rapidly and more completely from an emotional level than people who don't have it. It's about 20% of the population. So it's actually pretty common. It's not even a disorder. But the way you control it or don't control it can then manifest as a disorder. So that's where, if we had had the proper controls in the healthy environment, if my dad had not been raped as a child, I believe we could have basically capitalized on the upside of this wiring and mitigated the downside if we had had. If my father had not been traumatized, and then if he had not passed that trauma down to us.
The interesting character in your book, the most interesting in my view, is the one that gets the least attention, and from my perspective, considering the monumental impact she had, and that's your mother. And so your father, with his tyrannical delusions and that sort of thing, comes across as a villain in the story. And I say that understanding that his own family of origin, but when you look at how he impacted his own children, but he had help in this. And I was wondering how you process or have processed your relationship with your mother, considering her enabling of his behavior and her lack of protection for you children.
Melissa, it's really interesting you say that because that was kind of the sleeper epiphany for me after I wrote the book, was how much I realized my mother was a significant contributor to his abuse. And I wrote an op-ed for The Federalist. Sorry, it's a competitor, but about there was a case that just happened recently. There was just a sentencing. These two women got 30 years in prison out in Utah for this horrific child abuse case. And what had happened was, according to the court reports, the older woman had spent her time kind of being a life coach, and it almost created like her own version of a cult. They were both within the official LDS church, but again, similar to my father, had had a toxic interpretation of it and had gone to extreme levels. the older woman comes into the community and gets the younger woman who's the mother of six children. I think there were only two living at home. They were, you know, the older ones were out, I believe, maybe two or three. So it was only the younger ones who fell into the prey of this woman. But they were both sentenced to 30 years in prison. And the one who was the mother, she's a YouTube star. Her name is Ruby Frank, and the YouTube channel is now defunct, but she at one point had millions of followers. Mm-hmm. And she said that she fell under the spell of this charismatic, basically cult leader woman, and basically did her bidding and abused their children. And the court said that this was, they called it concentration camp like conditions. And they duct taped the children, they starved them, they made them work out in the hot sun without shoes and very hot in Utah, southern Utah. And they only found out about it because the boy ran away to the neighbor's house while he was duct taped and begged for help. And I'm like, where was the father in this situation? Because I think they had been separated and he moved out. But in my view, he should be held accountable as well. But I bring it up to say that both these women were held accountable for the abuse, both the enabler and the woman who had sort of been the genesis of it. And I think that that's something when I was writing the book, I had always perceived of my mother as a victim, which she was. But if you don't protect your children, and I've now seen this with friends of mine, where a friend of mine's mother, she had been abused by her husband, and then she just took it. But then once he started to abuse the children, she's like, that's it, we're done. And so she was able to rescue the children and they were healthy. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, my mother was not that strong. And I wish, and she almost left him. I talk in the book about how she almost left him when I was 10 years old and how I used to fantasize about her leaving him and how life could have been different. And we had the child custody authorities try to take us away at one point. That was one of my first memories as a 4 or 5 year old or so. And, but yeah, I think for my mom, I didn't realize how much the enabling behavior had been modeled for me in my own relationships. And I have a chapter about that. And even to this day, I'm 41 years old. And as embarrassing as it is to admit, but I think I'm talking about it because I want other women or just anybody who's been abused and is in an enabling position. When I was 40 years old, like I spent my 40th birthday with a man I found out later was sleeping with two other women, had a DUI, and with major alcohol problems and national security violation problems, and was just a complete sociopath in terms of his behavior. And I'm like, I'm 40 years old. How am I still allowing this to happen? And I think part of it was because I had not significantly appreciated just how much my mother's, I'm like the perfect blend of both my parents. And I didn't realize that because I had always just thought of her as a victim, as opposed to someone who was actually proactively enabling the abuse as well.
Yeah, she had agency in this situation. And so the pattern into adulthood for you was, in some ways, especially with the male figures, modeling your mom's enabling behavior. I have great empathy for you, considering my own, you know, journey and past, and that's why I found your story so compelling. You mentioned throughout the book troubled relationships with your siblings. And one of the things that happens in families like this is that with each individual sibling dealing with a trauma in their own way, it can fracture the relationships between the siblings. And I was wondering how it is now, because you document some of the problems with some of your siblings, some ways that they rescued you at certain times, and also, a painful denouement, especially with the one schizophrenic brother who attempted to rape you when you went to forgive your father. And I was wondering, you know, I was like, there's a lot of siblings here. Are you close to any of them? How have they too suffered on this journey?
Yeah, I mean, and the author's note I have at the beginning of the book, I mentioned that I don't delve deeply into profiling all of them for privacy reasons. But I have said, and I said here, three of them have attempted suicide. I don't identify who or those are. I think I only talk about one circumstance that was because it was the brother. He tried to rape me when I was 17, and then he went out and tried to kill himself in front of a bus. But he's schizophrenic, so I knew not to blame him because he was ill. But at the same time, when you're living in close quarters with someone who has this fantasy about you, it's not a safe place. But in terms of the relationships, they're constantly up and down. So I could tell you the way things are now, and then it could be very different in a few months, unfortunately. I have reached out to several siblings and said, I would like to have a more consistent relationship, but in order to do that, we need to get a third party. And I'm willing to pay for a family therapist, a neutral person that they can choose. I don't have to choose them. And they haven't taken me up on that. So I'm waiting for that day. I hope it happens. I do have a brother who I'm very close with, and we've grown together even spiritually. And then I have a lot of extended family who is supportive. I do talk in the book about how I had to, in some ways, forgive them for not stepping in, including my grandparents for not stepping in and stopping my dad from devolving the way he devolved and doing what he did to us. And that whole journey of forgiving everyone, but also not allowing more hurt. And I think more broadly, the reason I chose to write this book right now is I saw what's happening in our country, that my problems, yes, they're personal, but at the end of the day, they're actually not really. Like the Bible says, there's nothing new under the sun, that every trauma that I've experienced has been experienced probably by millions of people. It's just that I happen to have a lot more in one bundle versus, segmented. And so the fact that we have the highest suicide rate since 1941, we have the highest depression rate ever. The Gen Z suicide rate for women, so like young women, college age, high school age now, it's almost doubled what it was for Gen X women when they were that age. And we had the highest number of suicides ever. The most recent data we have is 2022, and it was almost 50,000 people. So a whole football stadium committing suicide. And so something's not right. And there are a lot of things that I think are driving this, from spiritual decay to social media and technology, and the fact that these technology companies know how addictive and destructive these algorithms are, and how The Atlantic just had a story about how adolescents, the number of adolescents who say they go out with friends, I think it was two or times more a week, been plummeting ever since the smartphone came on the scene. And so people are trying to have relationships online, and it's just cannot compensate for what for real in-person fellowship. And that's a big part of the mental health decline. And so I feel like with the book, I kind of in some ways have a lead in on that, and what I've seen is that, and it's interesting because especially some conservatives are like, oh, it's all made up. This is all nonsense. The mental health crisis is nonsense. And I'm like, I agree and I disagree with that. And the reasons are is, well, I just quoted all these numbers. So you're telling me that they're not real dead bodies? Are these not real people who are killing themselves? And this is not a real opioid crisis. So it's real in that sense, but I do agree in the sense that it is self-sabotage. It is self-created. It is the addictive behaviors that can be broken. And so in that respect, it gives me comfort and hope because I've gotten through a lot of that. I don't have suicidal ideation anymore. I mean, I have bad days, but because of the tools I've been able to develop, the spiritual and Christian community I've been able to get rooted in, I'm in a much better place.
Well, I there's multiple cultural things that are happening at the same time, right? You've got the breakdown of the family. You have people, young people secularizing and their parents just not taking them to church. And then COVID that dropped off a cliff for in certain communities. Then you have the online and the technology that gives this false sense of intimacy, but really doesn't have, form basis for real meaningful friendships. And on top of that, there's internet forums filled with the crazy loons, and heaven forbid a child finds one of those places and goes off into weirdo land. And so there's just so many ways now, and pressures on these young people. So it's definitely legitimate. I also think the lack of external, in some cases, not in your case, and not in many other cases, if you look at mental illness, particularly in young women, tends to be affluent liberal parents, and the numbers of kids on antidepressants and that sort of thing is really truly astonishing. So there's so many factors at play, but you put it, and then you have toxic ideologies where the world's going to end because of climate change or something, and you have this brew of helplessness and hopelessness, which is a prescription for psychological disaster. You struggled with all of those things for years and then had them reinforced by the relationships you entered in. You were agnostic for what was it, 13 years, did you say?
Been about 12 years, yeah, roughly.
12 years. And so we're floating in this wilderness and had experiences with Buddhism and then with you read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations and went through a Stoicism phase before finding Christianity. And I found that interesting and curious, trying to get some order in your life through self-discipline and perfectionism in a way. But found it wanting. And I was wondering why you found that wanting.
Yeah, and I agree with everything you said as far as the young people and just, in general society secularizing. And I went through that phase as a response in large degree to the toxic abuse I had seen done in the name of God. And I think that a lot of young people are doing this for the similar reasons, whether it's a, pedophile scandal in the Catholic Church or in money being embezzled or, women being abused in churches. There's a lot of just visceral aversion to the church. And I wrestle with that in the book. And eventually, by going through this journey that you're talking about, I realized one of the major themes of the book is that God is not religion. And for me, going through these other disciplines and worldviews and practices of Buddhism and Stoicism, I think there's truth and there's value in those walks. And I talk in the Buddhist situation, I actually got kicked out of a Buddhist, the mainstream service, because my leg had an injury and he said I wasn't folding my legs right during the meditation on the cushions. And I was like, and he didn't speak English well. And I was trying to explain that my leg was injured, but he was having none of it. So he was like, go away, go sit over there against the wall. That was kind of embarrassing, but it also,
It was kind of comical. One of my favorite,
yeah.
here's a Buddhist where, I think of two things in Caddyshack on my deathbed, I'll have total consciousness. And also I have a greeting card that says, Hello Dolly, which is the Dalai Lama. And on the inside, it says, nothing, just what I always wanted. So that's interesting that these a peaceful monk, I'm assuming, booted you, which takes some doing. I give you credit for that. And then you went to a more stoicism and meditating on meditations every day, and yet it still wasn't enough. What wasn't enough about it?
Yeah, so I think Stoicism is very cerebral. And there is a growing, and when I got into it, and I was a Forbes contributor at the time, and my most popular article for Forbes was a piece I'd written about Stoicism and how it was making a comeback, and it's made even more of a comeback since then. And so there is more of a community, I would say, of people interested in Stoicism. So back when I was writing about it, there really wasn't so much, or it was just kind of bubbling up. So there is more of a community, but back then that was something I was kind of missing, was that community feel that was part of it. But I think even more important philosophically, I didn't it because the thing about Stoicism is you could be a Christian Stoic, you could be a Buddhist Stoic, you could be a Muslim Stoic. It's actually not a religion in the typical sense. It's more just kind of a philosophy and a worldview and a way of looking at the world. And I think for me, it seemed a little bit void. It seemed a bit void of just what I found in Christianity, because it's interesting because Paul in the Bible talks about Stoics, and he talks about some of these similar genres back then and how they had, assigned a temple to the unknown God, and how it's really Stoicism. They say you just leave it up to fate. And amor fati, love of fate. And it's really kind of just amorphous. What is, the Stoic prayer is that, God grant me the serenity to, accept the things that cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That it is in that sense very empowering, because you can make better choices, you can accept horrific trauma and understand that you can't change it, you can't hold that anger in, you can let it go. Like, those are all positive things. But this idea of it just being up to fate, as opposed to there is a divine creator who loves you, who proactively created this earth the way that it is, it didn't make sense to me as I started to study metaphysics and just the statistical probabilities of creation, that it wasn't just some random slime or random fate that Earth is the way that it is, that it actually takes more faith to just believe in random chance or random fate than it does to see how the Earth is at, like, humanity here at this velocity, the Earth at this tilt, at this temperature, that our heads are not exploding. Like, it is truly miraculous when you're speaking mathematically. It's I and you always say it's like you have to go almost infinite zeros all the way out, decimal points, 0.1 likelihood that it happened, which is basically zero. And so I say it's almost like a tornado randomly going through a junkyard and randomly assembling a complex nuclear weapon system. And so I felt like Stoicism was in some ways just kind of passive, in the sense that it didn't answer those questions of, is there a God? Does God love me? And in Christianity, God loves humanity so much that he came down and experienced the suffering. I still don't understand why he did that. I understand the thinking behind it, and that to me is a beautiful thing, in the sense that he experienced that level of empathy and sympathy. And just when you and I were talking about, you've had similar experiences, so you have an empathy and sympathy and understanding that other people who weren't raised in our situations, they just don't have it. And so I appreciate that from the Christian's perspective of understanding suffering and finding meaning in suffering. I still don't understand why this was the way it is. I don't understand why we have malaria. I don't understand why we have child. I mean, I know that humanity is broken and they're the ones doing it, but I still don't understand why, in some respects, God gave free agency. He respects free. I mean, in the Bible, it talks about how Jesus, he views the city of Jerusalem and he weeps and he says, "Oh, Jerusalem, oh, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you under my wing." When I was reflecting on that one day, I said, "This is the creator of the universe, and he's weeping because they won't do what he wants them to do." It's like he could just force them to do anything, but he respects their free will that much. to allow it to happen. So it helped me, I don't know, I think Christianity has a better understanding for how the world is. I still don't understand why, but that's where, again, faith in a creator who ordered the world the way it is. I just didn't find that in Stoicism or in Buddhism.
Well, we could talk for a lot longer about this, I think. But I think that's a good place to stop because it's clear that healing came through your conversion to Christianity and you found peace in a way that you haven't had before. So please tell people where they can find you, where they can find your book. I've got it right here. It's called Motorhome Prophecies. I hope you all go out and buy this because in for those, there's so many kind of cults going on right now because society is so fractured. People who have been, and I'm going to be talking to our next guest is going to be talking about transgenderism. There's many different ways people are being pulled into ideologies that are self-destructive, but seem like an answer and an external solution to an internal problem. And so you've managed to find your way out. And I really thank you for sharing your story. But tell everybody where they can find you because, this is just the beginning of a conversation, really.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And absolutely, I would love to connect with people. And again, yes, would love folks to read the book. Again, the title, thanks for holding it up. Here it is, Motorhome Prophecies, a journey of healing and forgiveness. Support your local bookstore if you can. If not, there's the big retailers. And I'm on social media. I'm on Twitter. I also have a Substack newsletter, so feel free to sign up on there and get
What
up.
is your Twitter and what are all, can you give everybody your addresses so they can like specifically find you?
Sure, I'm at Twitter at Carrie Sheffield, so one word, and Instagram it's Sheffield Carrie, and Facebook it's Carrie Sheffield, and I'm also on Getter for Carrie Sheffield. So if you look for Carrie Sheffield, it should pop up. I've also got
Okay,
a
great.
page, so I'm there.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing your story and being so transparent about it. I read the book and I was just like, this woman has unbelievable courage to talk about it in this way. So thank you very much for sharing it, and I urge everybody to go out and read it. And I hope to talk to you again soon and get an update at some point because I feel like the story isn't finished.
No, it's the last chapter is called Wrestling with God, and it's a never-ending wrestle. I think that's the entire human journey is a one wrestle with God.
All right, well, thank you everybody for listening. Like and subscribe here at The Spectacle. You can find us at spectator.org, spectator.org. And of course, you can find me on Twitter, Melissa Tweets, and also everywhere else you guys know. So come back in a couple of days. We're going to have another great guest on following this, talking with Carrie. And I urge you to get her book once again. It's a fantastic read. So thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you soon.